Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's budget proposal that increases spending on defense, homeland security, and veterans, while cutting spending on diplomacy and the environment by one-third, cutting health, agriculture, and labor by one-fifth, followed by 10 to 15% cuts in commerce, education, housing, transportation, and interior, down to smaller cuts in everything else. A former member of President Obama's economic team, who was the chief economic advisor to Vice President Biden, Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, joins us. We'll discuss a budget that Trump says is about keeping America safe, even though the U.S. spends more than most of the rest of the world combined on defense and faces no significant threats as China slows its military spending, and Trump's increase of $54 billion in defense is about the total of what Russia spends on defense per year. Then we'll examine the impact of Trump's budget on the poor and speak with David Bradley, the executive director of the National Community Action Foundation, who has been one of Washington's leading advocates on behalf of low-income programs. He joins us to discuss how the eroding support for Donald Trump's replacement of Obamacare makes this budget dead on arrival, with Democrats appalled by the harshness of the cuts, while some Republicans are unhappy with the budget that does not go far enough in cutting the growth of entitlements. Then finally, we will speak with a former U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, Cynthia Schneider, distinguished professor in the practice of diplomacy at George Washington University, who is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She joins us to discuss the victory of the Dutch center-right party, meaning that Geert Wilders, the racist friend of Stephen Bannon and Nigel Farage, who came in a distant second, will not form a government. We will look into the surprise victory of the youthful Green Left Party, which made the most gains, that is led by 30-year-old Jesse Klaver, who is half Moroccan and half Indonesian. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And the Trump budget takes an axe to just about everything else but defense, which is up by about 10%. Homeland Security is up by 7%. Veterans Affairs up by 6%. But the big hits are in the Environmental Protection Agency is cut by 31%, state by 29%, agriculture by 21%, labor by 21%, health and human services by 18%, commerce by 16%, education 14%, housing and urban development 13%, transportation 13%, interior 12%, energy 6%, small business 5%, treasury 4%, justice 4%, and NASA 1%. So this looks like Trump has really taken a cleaver to the very fabric of this nation.
That's certainly the way I look at it, and the way that many people who are concerned about the well-being of less well-off people in the communities that they live in are looking at this budget throughout the day, and especially on top of the recent changes that the Republicans have proposed for health care, which Trump also backs, which again kind of look out at the nation and decide that poor people are doing great and rich people, and in this case defense, need more money.
But defense needing more money, I mean, we spend more than just about the rest of the world combined on defense, and most of the other countries in that list are allies, like 7 out of 10 of them are. China's military spending is slowing. The increase of $54 billion in defense is about what Russia spends per year on defense.
You're exactly right. Russia spends about $50 billion per year. Our $54 billion plus up gets us to over $600 billion per year, which is more than the next 7 highest spending nations combined. I think you're raising something that, interestingly, and I think tellingly, doesn't get raised very much. I mean, I'm in Washington, and I got to tell you that people are, it's not that we didn't expect this budget, but people are just kind of shocked that you're seeing just the gutting of so much of the discretionary side of the budget outside of defense. But very few people are saying, well, does defense really need that kind of a plus-up? And you know, that question doesn't get asked enough. I happen to ask a couple of experts, people who really, you know, spent decades looking at the defense budget. Larry Korb is one of them, is actually used to work for the Reagan administration. And he wrote in an article that Trump's defense spending could actually make the U.S. Less safe than it is. I mean, one of the things that Korb pointed out was that, you know, when you kind of spend excessively without any kind of strategic purpose, it doesn't really help you. He wrote, just as the sequester, these other budget cuts are a non-strategic and unwise way to limit a budget, increased funding that's not connected to a sound defensive strategy for the demands we face today will be non-strategic, wasteful, and do more harm than good.
But it's all being done in the name of keeping America safe. As, according to the Trump spokesperson, a budget that puts America first must make the safety of our people its number one priority, because without safety, there can be no prosperity. Now, one of the things, of course, it's taking a big hit, apart from the environment that takes the biggest hit. The second biggest hit is to the State Department. And for reasons which are mystifying me, the Secretary of State, who appears to have been somewhat humiliated, if not emasculated, he's sort of saying, well, you know, we can handle it. But this is diplomacy. Now, if you look at what the real threat that everybody is saying Russia poses today, it's not a nuclear war. It is what this hybrid warfare that Putin has become an expert in. And it's basically Russia's version of soft power. And many historians argue that the U.S. won, in quotes, the Cold War through soft power. It wasn't our missiles. It was rock and roll that eventually brought down the Iron Curtain. So, and it looks like Putin's figured that out too. So he uses soft power very effectively, for example, in Western Europe and here in the United States in manipulating our elections. We're cutting the soft power budget to the bone, or in fact eviscerating it altogether. That makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on what we're talking about right now, so I don't want to wade into it very far.
Right.
But you really have to follow the money in these kinds of budgets. What I read very much underscores everything you just said. And again, I've talked to Lawrence Korb. I've talked to another defense strategist who I won't name because we talked off the record, who also agreed that this $54 billion plus up, taking defense annual expenditures to over $600 billion, is not necessary. And, you know, remember, there are a lot of defense contractors who very much like to see that kind of an increase, and this kind of defense industrial complex that I think it was Eisenhower warned us about low these many years ago is, of course, you know, very much alive and well. And that's been a problem for a long time. I think what's new here is that in order to make the budget that Trump has proposed revenue neutral, that is, so it doesn't increase the budget deficit, he's taking that $54 billion back from programs on the non-defense side of the budget. And these are programs like Meals on Wheels, you know, for elderly people who are shut-ins, or the LIHEAP program, which is a program that helps older people pay their heating bills, or the Appalachian Development Function, which helps rural areas with economic development, and, you know, many, many more just like that. So my first point, I call this a plowshares to swords budget. My first point is that it's not just that we're plussing up defense in a way that is probably really wasteful. It's that we're taking it out of the hides of people who kind of depend on a lot of this sort of help to make ends meet.
So I brought up the soft power issue, Jared, because I have a background in nuclear arms control. But the one senator who has stepped forward on the Republican side is Lindsey Graham, and he said, I won't let them cut our soft power budget. I won't let it happen. So what's your sense of the Republican resistance to it? Okay, I know the Democrats are absolutely appalled. But, you know,
no, it's a really important point. And in fact, in a way, it's a a more important point than the appalled Democrats, because, of course, Trump's play is to try to get his budget through on a tactic called reconciliation, which is just a complicated word we use down here to mean a budget that can't be filibustered, so he could pass it with solely Republican support. So the fact that the members of the Republican caucus are souring on the budget is really important, and leads me to predict pretty confidently that this budget isn't going anywhere legislatively. Okay, so that's important, and so I don't want to discount what we've said so far, because what we've said so far hopefully helps our listeners get inside the priorities of the Trump administration, and that, you know, they're not going away just because he once again is at loggerheads with Republicans in Congress. But, you know, John Thune, who's a high-ranking Republican in the Senate, argued that the domestic spending cuts went too far. Mitch McConnell, who's pretty important, Senate Majority Leader, argued that the 29% cut to the State Department was too deep. So, you know, that gives you a sense. And even some of the hard right kind of rural district Tea Party Republicans were giving this budget some blowback based on cuts of programs that mean something to their constituents. For example, there was a cut, there's a cut, or actually a zeroing out, I believe, of a program that subsidizes air travel to rural areas. Well, once some of these members started hearing about that, they were up in arms. And so I think the point is that when you talk to members of Congress who don't really know the details of budgets very well, and you tell them, we're going to do we're just going to cut the heck out of everything, they say, that sounds great. I mean, if that's the kind of conservative they are, when you start showing them the actual cuts on the ground, not so good.
But is Donald Trump basically, he seems to be locked into this idea that he has to fulfill every campaign promise he made. And we all know the politicians say stuff on the stump that they don't really mean and try to back away from and deal with reality later. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And I don't understand why it is that you would feel compelled to do stuff that makes no sense just because you promised
him. He's not fulfilling every promise he made by quite a long shot. So, for example, Donald Trump promised that in his administration there would be no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Well, this health care proposal that came out this week and that he is to this day backing and trying to sell to constituents in these rallies he's been doing, cuts Medicaid, low-income health coverage for poor people, Medicaid, by 25%, almost $900 billion over the course of 10 years, and 14 million Medicaid recipients, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, will lose coverage under this plan. So he hasn't done that. He's talked about renegotiating trade deals. He hasn't done any of that. He's talked about helping some of the kinds of left behind constituents that have been hurt by globalization, about helping them with jobs and incomes. I haven't seen anything like that. And in fact, interestingly and revealingly, Donald Trump is yet to pass one piece of legislation. He has yet, In other words, not that he passes legislation by himself, but the Congress has to do it. He is yet to herald one piece of legislation that he has favored through the Congress. The only thing that Donald Trump has done so far is signed his name to executive orders, which he can do. He can sign his name. And even some of those have gone down, thankfully, because of the intervention of the courts.
And, of course, this highly touted $1 trillion infrastructure plan, that appears to be, certainly it's not in this budget, so I don't know what's happening with that. But I was really sort of referring more than anything else to this wall that he keeps talking about. And he has asked for $2.6 billion for 2018 on top of $1.7 billion for this year. So that seems to be, because it's, I spoke with a defense expert yesterday who said, that it looks like Donald Trump's foreign policy and military policies are based upon pandering to his constituents. Whether it makes any sense to do what he's doing is not the point, that he's really about pandering to his constituency. And that's a shrinking constituency, as far as I know.
I think, there is something to be said for doing that kind of, something to be said. Presidents pander. That's not exactly a newsflash. And the fact that he is trying to in some cases, when it's convenient, I guess, legislate stuff, or at least raise stuff that he ran on, doesn't really surprise me. I think what's really important and interesting is that he has no political base from which to do any of that. Now, if he is simply, if it's simply a conversation between Donald Trump and, as you suggest, probably a relatively small and shrinking base about all these things that I said I'd run on, and now I'm going to talk about them and, you know, get you riled up about them again. But they're not going anywhere because I have no idea how to govern and I have no political coalition. Then that's obviously a very, you know, that's going to be a very weird and very unfortunate 4 years for America. But that's what's happening thus far. That is, Donald Trump is signaling a certain contingent of his base that he knows what he ran on, and he's going to write legislation that does some of that stuff, but he has no ability to govern or to he has thus far shown no ability to govern or to put together a coalition to make any of that any of those ideas come to legislative life.
But it's been said that a budget is in many ways a sort of DNA of the country and its political DNA, and to some extent is a kind of implicit moral judgment. Do you see that in this context? Because I don't. I see this as being capricious, cruel, unnecessary, and not driven by any real needs, any threats, anything that the nation faces, except, you know, this strange idea that you know we don't need diplomacy, we need more strength. When we got more strength than anybody else on the block by an extraordinary factor, I just don't see the core reality to this, except that it's kind of nasty.
I think that's a fair description. I think that from what I can tell, Donald Trump and the people with whom he has surrounded himself do not have a core philosophy of government that suggests either government is here to kind of help people when the market fails them. If you go back to Barack Obama, I mean, Barack Obama was not by any stretch of the imagination, Barack Obama was not nearly as socialistic or far left as people like to say he was, but he certainly recognized that there was a role for government when markets failed to provide opportunities to people who'd been left behind, and that was always in his budgets in great detail. Those budgets didn't get very far either, by the way, because of political gridlock. I agree with you if what you're saying is that it's really hard to find any kind of core principle, even a right-wing principle, something a more kind of what you might associate with George Bush or George Herbert Walker Bush, or even Ronald Reagan, you know, kind of an idea that, yes, there is a role for government in hard power and soft power, but for the most part, we want to deregulate and get government out of the way. You know, Reagan actually had quite a bit of success, and to some extent, the Bush presidents as well, in terms of legislating their agenda. But you don't see that happening here at all.
Well, Jared Bernstein, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities from 2009 to 2011. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the impact of Trump's budget on the poor.
Paper, and in the middle of negotiating. patience you break down. I never give you my number.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Bradley, who's Executive Director of the National Community Action Foundation. He's been one of Washington's leading advocates on behalf of low-income programs and previously worked in congressional affairs at the Small Business Administration under President Jimmy Carter. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Bradley.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of the outlines of Donald Trump's new budget? It does seem that it's basically eviscerating almost everything, at least from my point of view, that I think is important in order to throw money at the Pentagon. And the amount of extra money that he's throwing at the Pentagon, $54 billion, is the entire annual budget of Russia's military, which is presumably the number one enemy of the United States at this point. And then Homeland Security gets more money, and everything else pretty much is being cut. So how does it strike you?
Well, I think the Trump proposed 18 budget is a second body blow to America's communities and America's middle class and those struggling to make it to the middle class. First, you had the deep cuts and the confusion and over the Obamacare repeal and replace. That has caught people off guard and certainly shown that the promise that no one will lose their coverage and premiums will be lower to be false. And the second is cuts proposed all across the board, as you pointed out, that no community in America was asking for, no elected officials were asking for, that is catching America, red states, blue states, all across the board, in catching them and surprising them with the viciousness of some of the proposed cuts. This is, ironically, for a president who pledged to drain the swamp, this is a budget that simply has replaced the creatures in the swamp, and this budget is driven by right-wing Washington insiders. This is not a populist budget developed around the country. This is an inside the beltway, very, very conservative budget that fortunately is dead on arrival in Congress.
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are encouraged to hear that, but why do you say it's dead on arrival?
Well, I think that senior Republicans, senior appropriators, I've been with a number of bipartisan members today, both parties, both House and Senate side. And they feel that the big issues on whether it's tax reform, health care, then you got infrastructure, they're going to feel some pressure from the Trump administration to at least try to give some assurance or some negotiations to try to support the president. But all along, members have been saying that on 2018, Congress is an equal branch. We're gonna make some decisions. We know what our communities need, what our communities want, and what works in our communities. And I am hearing all across the board that the cuts on domestic discretionary, which is what we're talking about, senior Republicans saying they're just not going to fly. We just cannot go down that. Now, what it may mean is we're going to be in a standoff, a stalemate for a while over spending, but I am convinced that after all these lean years on domestic discretionary spending, that enough Republicans are going to stand up and say, you know, we just can't make any more cuts in this area, or we disagree strongly with some of your recommendations, Mr. President. I'm still an optimist that Congress will do the right thing on this debate. This defines us as a country, as a society, and I'm still convinced that enough Republicans will stand up to President Trump.
So at the end of the day, that would mean that there are enough Americans who care about the environment, who care about diplomacy, who care about health, who care about housing, and who care about the arts, are willing to stand up. And do you think it's going to require I mean, first of all, in terms of the first body blow that you mentioned, David Bradley, which is the evisceration of the Affordable Care Act with Paul Ryan's new Ryan Care, there has been a lot of pushback at these town hall meetings where people who don't want to lose their healthcare coverage. And that seems to have gotten the attention of a number of senators, at least, where Ryan Care may well be in trouble. So can the same activism, is the same activism going to be necessary? In other words, people in this country who care about the environment, diplomacy, housing, health services, and the arts, are they going to stand up and be counted?
Yes, but it's a two-part answer. So the first easy response to your question, your good question, is yes, I think they will stand up. I think they will speak out. But the second prong of that is that when members of Congress do the right thing, be they Republican, Democrat, Senate, House, conservative, liberal, what's going to be important, just as it's important to say you've done the wrong thing, it's going to be important to say you've done the right thing. Members, there's a reason Congress only has an 8% approval rating. No one's happy in their job, and they feel that if they walk the plank on tough issues, they get no credit for it. They possibly face a primary. They feel their constituents don't either understand or care. Well, when members, if we can get them, and if the country gets members to make the correct decision, as we all know they should, it's important that members hear from their communities, their constituencies, we recognize you did the right thing, and by the way, thank you.
And again, I'm speaking with David Bradley, the Executive Director of the National Community Action Foundation. He's been one of Washington's leading advocates on behalf of low-income programs and previously worked in congressional affairs at the Small Business Administration under President Jimmy Carter. So when I mentioned earlier some of the stuff that the president's going to be spending money on at the expense of diplomacy, the arts, the environment, housing, health services, etc., defense being a big one, homeland security. But the other one that's just absolutely extraordinary is building this damn wall on the Mexican border, which is a crazy idea, completely impractical. At the end of the day, it doesn't do anything except to destroy the local ecology because of the inability of little critters and animals to be able to carry on normally. It's just a blot on the horizon. And it all goes back to his campaign promises. And it seems that we have a president who is pandering to an increasingly shrinking mandate that he claims to have from people who voted for him, who he's going to screw over in any case. But somehow him and Bannon have this idea that we're going to fulfill all of our promises, no matter how crazy these promises were.
Well, I think you're absolutely right on that. And the wall was controversial within Congress anyway before this budget. But let's just take your issue of the wall. It also points up the hypocrisy of Trump's 2018 proposal. We're going to build a wall at the same time we're going to cut the Coast Guard, or we're going to cut Homeland Security, or some of these other programs that are necessary for local law enforcement. This is an extreme budget that is based on the populist campaign, nationalist campaign that Trump designed with Bannon and others in the administration. And I don't think the vast majority of Congress is in the same place as the president.
So the area that you work in, David Brantley, which is advocating on behalf of low-income programs, particularly there in the nation's capital, which is, talk about a tale of two cities, it's a tale of one city, you know, a bunch of rich lobbyists in one part and a lot of low-income people in another. And Trump's budget is going to cut Meals on Wheels, which provides meals for seniors. He's going to cut food stamps and nutrition programs. He's also going to cut low-cost home energy assistance and rental assistance and home ownership programs. I might add that the first executive order that he signed was to make mortgages more expensive for middle-class and working American families. So right out of the gate, people should have noticed that signal. One of the things that we're always told about politics is that the poor don't vote, so therefore we don't care about them. At least that's the attitude, particularly in Republican circles. Does that hold?
No, I think that there is a viable radical center in Congress that that encompasses both parties, members of both parties that care about the poor as much as they care about middle or upper income kind of issues. And what I would hope, though, I think it's going to be an incredible debate that'll last over the summer about the role of government, our vision, our values that we want for society. Members are going to have to make some tough choices, but I would. This is probably the conservative side of me would say that we also have to be reasonable in what we expect or hope to happen on this. Certainly, hard assessment of what defense needs or the wall or things that we've talked about there that Trump is proposing. I hope Congress spends a lot of time, digs down and understands and sees maybe some alternatives to the figures that the president has proposed. But on some of these other programs, people are going to have to be prepared, as much as great as the need is, for some lean years. Lean years does not mean 10, 20, 30% reduction or even elimination. Lean years may mean be prepared for 1 or 2 or 3 years of no increases. Well, if it is a just and fair budget in which everyone is asked to sacrifice, including defense or including those at the top rung of the economic ladder, I think everyone needs to say we can do our part. I know the programs I'm involved with, I'm telling Congress, hey, we can, you know, don't cut us, but if you have to, do it fairly all across the board, if that's what it takes to get to keep government functioning and to keep the economy moving forward. I don't think we're going to get to that point. I think we're going to get to that to the point of Congress is willing to keep a lot of programs at current funding, because every one of the programs that President Trump is trying to eliminate, there are strong constituencies in Congress, bipartisan constituencies that support those programs.
Well,
so it's not today is the top of the first inning. Trump's at bat. Maybe he scored a run, but now it's the good guys. It's Congress and it's others. It's their turn at bat, and they've got some weapons in their lineup, and I think Congress will consistently push back on these 2018 funding decisions.
Well, for the longest time, as far as I can recall, there's been virtually no discussion in Washington, or very little, on revenues. It's always cut, particularly when you have Republicans in office. And obviously, George W. Bush gave massive tax cuts to the rich. And the inequality in this country is manifest. It's clear. It's been growing. You know, back in the halcyon days of the American dream under President Dwight David Eisenhower, the rich paid 92% tax. Now they're, you know, carried interest is 15%. It's gone up a little bit under Obama, but Trump's cut the taxes on the rich in order to pay for parts of the Affordable Care Act. At least that's the proposal. Mm-hmm. No talk about revenue enhancement. And in fact, there's talk about more cuts, tax cuts for the rich. So is there a way that we can talk about the flip side of this? And by the way, a part of this is across-the-board cuts is more cutting at the IRS, which can barely function with the money they have. So they're the people who collect money. They're the only part of the government that actually makes money as opposed to spends money. And what are they doing? They're making it impossible for them to collect what money they do. So to my mind, does anybody ever talk about revenues in Washington?
It's a good question. Yes, they do, but it depends on what side of the coin you're on. Some talk about revenues and wanting to cut entitlements. Others talk about revenues and cut domestic discretionary. Democrats talk about fairness throughout the tax code that involves having those at the top 1% or so pay more of their fair share. Let me point this out. I think I think that there was a feeling within the Trump administration, and certainly within certain Republican circles in Congress, that repeal and replace Obamacare would be the easy thing, the one that low-hanging fruit that they go through first, that they could get a consensus and move forward. Every issue coming after that was always expected to be harder. Next up, look, an Affordable Care Act replacement is in trouble. Next up is tax reform. And I think it's going to be, particularly if there's not a big success, not a lot of momentum by President Trump on health care. And I think getting agreement, not only among Republicans, but certainly almost no bipartisan support among Democrats, makes tax reform, in terms of what Trump wants to do, extremely doubtful in the United States Senate. So that just as domestic discretionary programs I'm involved with, we look at a very, very steep hill. We've got to climb to survive and be successful this year. I think the road and the congressional path forward for the Trump administration gets harder each and every passing week as they start looking at further issues down the road. Tax reform is next up. No easy sell among Republicans, let alone the fact that they're most likely going to have no Democratic support.
But I asked you earlier, David Bradley, about the notion that's often put forth that the reason the Republicans can get away with this particularly cruel budget that appears to be very heartless and random and un-American in many ways, the poor don't vote. So is that an issue? In other words, is there, from your work working with the poor, is that a fact that the poor don't vote? And if so, is there a way to get them to vote so that you don't have these heartless people like Donald Trump or Mike Lee, the senator from Utah and others, and the numbers crunching guy that they've got behind this budget, who just have no humanity? It's all about numbers, and they spend all their time on the phone asking rich people for money. So that's their world. So can we have a more inclusive America that can stand up for its rights, if indeed the problem here is that enough people that are affected by this kind of budget are not participating, if that's a correct assumption?
Well, the short answer to the first part of your question was, you're right. I don't think the poor or low income vote nearly enough, and they need to vote more. The little bit longer answer is there's a lot of anger in the country. You see it. I'm sure that your listeners have talked about it. I'm sure as you travel around, you visit. And the one thing that unites is there's anger on the right. There's anger on the left. But generally speaking, a lot of the anger and the anger groups are not connected. They may not accept Trump, but they're not necessarily Democrats. Or they might be angry over various issues that operate independently. The one thing that I think the Trump budget will do is it will unite those groups. Those working families in Appalachia didn't vote for some of these cuts, or didn't vote for President Trump to see these cuts. They didn't vote for President Trump to see their health care eviscerated the way it is. And I think what President Trump is doing on this extreme agenda, this nationalist agenda, It's not only Banyan or Mulvaney, but it's also Miller and others. What I think that budget and what their proposals are likely to do is, in a very short order, connect the dots and unite those that are dissatisfied and disaffected from Washington. That's a pretty powerful coalition. And included in there will be low income, but included in there also will be women and those concerned about arts and those concerned about education. Those concerned about so many health, so many other issues. And that's a powerful coalition. So they've got to stay engaged. They've got to stay committed. And they've got to stay angry in a professional sense, not in a illegal sense, but in a professional sense. They've got to stay angry and know that 2018 is going to make a difference for this country, what happens in November of that year.
Well, David Bradley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Bradley, who's Executive Director of the National Community Action Foundation. He has been one of Washington's leading advocates on behalf of low-income programs and previously worked in congressional affairs at the Small Business Administration under President Jimmy Carter. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a former U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands about the surprise results in the Dutch elections.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who is a distinguished professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From 1998 to 2001, she served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder.
Thank you very much for having me.
And were you in any way surprised by the results in the Dutch elections? There was a great deal of concern that the Party of Freedom, the Geert Wilders Party, would win. And there was a lot of hand-wringing over the possibility of a kind of racist right-wing party taking over the normally liberal and diverse and tolerant Dutch society. But it looks like Dutch traditions won out over media anxiety.
Well, I would say that I was certainly greatly relieved. I think everyone felt anxious that Wilders appeared, at least until about 2 weeks ago, to be doing as well as he was in Holland. I think now in 2020 hindsight, we can look back and see how much, particularly the international press, was looking at the Dutch election through a Trump prism. And I think that's understandable. I think many people, myself included, are still, very traumatized by the Trump victory. And, it basically gets worse every day. So the idea that this, could happen in a country that is so much associated with just the opposite tendencies, I think was a really terrifying one. And that's consequently you had Holland, which is indeed a wonderful place and a globally looking country, but still a pretty small place. You had Holland in the national and international news for like 3-4 days running as the main story. And I think it's really, really good news that the Dutch, in a sense, kind of claimed their heritage and indeed turned out for the Prime Minister Rutte, but also in large numbers, and this is true particularly of the youth, turned out for this new rock star of Dutch politics, which one might have thought might be an oxymoron, but nonetheless is rock star of Dutch politics, Jesse Klaver, who's Green Party rose really significantly. I mean, they just have 8.9% now. Rose from 4 seats in parliament to 14 and, attracted these large crowds of primarily young people. And I think we can take real encouragement from that because he, in a sense, offered the anti-Trump, the anti-Wilders message, even much more powerfully, actually, than Rutte did himself, who adopted some of that language. And what he offered was really a positive, dynamic, energetic vision for Holland, which attracted tremendous support, particularly among youth.
Well, the fact that Geert Wilders is a friend of Stephen Bannon, the White House strategist, who basically spends more time with Trump than anybody and essentially is the gatekeeper to the Oval Office. And he's also a friend of Nigel Farage, and a lot of money, I think over about $150,000, was put into his campaign by the far-right wing activist here in the United States, David Horowitz. Does that mean, to some extent, this is a bit of a repudiation for Donald Trump?
I first have to say I find that so charming that you consider $150,000 a lot of money in a campaign. Well, I wish that were true, but I know it's true for Holland. Of course, it is true for Holland.
Right.
You know, I wish this were a repudiation of Donald Trump. I think that's, you know, I honestly think that's going a little far. I hate to tell you, but even with the Netherlands being on CNN and the BBC for the last 3 days, I'm not quite sure that President Trump's support is really watching the Netherlands and taking a clue from it. But I think the reverse is true. It does show that somewhere after Brexit, after Trump's election, this is stopping. And someone is presenting quite a strong alternative. And I think that is really important. But I think something else is worth recognizing with Wilders. He is, at least in my experience of him, a kind of opportunistic Islamophobe racist. When I was ambassador 1990 to 2001, I knew Geert Wilders as a perfectly normal, well, with the exception of the hair, he always had that, but other than the hair, a perfectly normal member of parliament. And, you know, I talked with him about things I talked about with everyone else. There was not any indication of this racist ideology. And it seems to me, what happened, and friends of his have confirmed this, that and it started happening when I was there in 99, 2000, 2001, as the number of migrants in Holland increased and the unease around them increased, and there began to be percolating to the surface these racist sentiments, Geert Wilders appeared to have noticed that and to have recognized an opportunity for himself there to distinguish himself and not be just another member of parliament. And he took it. And, you know, that's what's gotten him, sadly. I mean, it's a sad comment on Holland, a sad comment on the world, but that is what lifts you above the crowd today. But that has gotten him to the position where he is today. So he may be friends with Bannon, he may be friends with Nigel Farage, it's not wildly surprising, but in my experience, I never knew him to be ideologically, personally driven in this direction. I think he's just trying to get ahead.
So, but surely on the other side, there's reason to be at least a little bit hopeful and even perhaps even celebrate with the victory of the Green Left that you mentioned, the 30-year-old Jesse Klaver, otherwise known as the Yesiah. And that party, by the way, apparently is a merger of communists, pacifists, evangelicals, and self-styled radicals. I mean, that's quite a potpourri, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a combination. It is indeed. But I think let's remember what their name is, the Green Left Party. And from what I can understand, again, with their support being significantly among the youth of Holland, it is indeed the issue of the environment that is really attracting these young people very significantly. They're the one party who's really talking about sustainability, which is a really big concern with young people. I think something to be worried about in Holland, and again, it's the same thing that we are suffering in the United States, is this really division in the divisions in society and the degree of fragmentation. Because, you know, even though the Prime Minister, Richard, won, and, you know, congratulations to him, all of the margins were really close. You know, and Wilders indeed didn't win, but he nonetheless gained seats, and he came in second And so that's still alarming. And, you know, when you think about it, there's a real irony here. You have Wilders, who runs on a racist platform, coming in second. And then the person who gained percentage-wise the most, Jesse Klaver, partially Moroccan, partially Indonesian, he's the new star of Dutch politics. So you have people moving really in two completely different directions. And, you know, I asked some Dutch people that, how could that be that someone then who's has Moroccan heritage is doing so well at this time of anti-Moroccan and sort of non-Dutch sentiments. And I was told that for the young voters who support Klaver, they care less. This is not even something they even notice, completely irrelevant. So that is, I think, something encouraging for the future.
Well, indeed, his platform was, just quoting him, stand for your principles, be straight, be pro-refugee, be pro-European. But in general, given that you've mentioned that Wilders nevertheless came in second and gained, obviously the fragmentation, the balkanization, if you will, of political parties, where you have 28 parties, and on this ballot apparently it was so complicated it was like a roadmap with all these parties, and you have the Party of Animals, which won 5 seats in the 150-seat parliament. You have DENK, which is a Turkish-Moroccan party. They got 3 seats, and the Eurosceptic Forum for Democracy got 2. So is that a case of too much identity politics?
No, I particularly like the Animal Party. I think maybe we ran the wrong species against Trump. Who knows? But I think identity politics is the name of the game in the world today. It's all about identity politics, which is a very scary thing, you know, because if we're ever to, you know, face some of the massive challenges that we face as a globe, notably the environment, but certainly conflict overall in this massive refugee crisis, it is not going to happen through identity politics. So that's a very scary turn. But identity politics can also be unifying. And I think another element that had an impact on the election was this whole dispute with Turkey over the weekend. And when Prime Minister Rutte stood up to Erdogan with his incredible comments about the Netherlands and Srebrenica and World War II, that also helped to unite people behind him, behind the prime minister, and they were glad to see him standing tall against these insults, really incredible insults that were being leveled against the Dutch. Now, you know, his developing the spine to do that might also have had something to do with the election. You know, Angela Merkel had a more moderated response when she got similar insults. But nonetheless, you know, I think the Dutch people were proud to see their prime minister standing up and defending their country and what it stands for. So that kind of identity can have a positive impact.
Well, clearly, though, Erdogan, the power-hungry president of Turkey, who's trying to gain more executive power in this upcoming April 16th referendum in Turkey, he provoked those incidents in Holland in order to get the kind of visuals that he had, and he was able to tell his constituents, see, the Europeans hate us, and et cetera, et cetera. And so it was very cynical on his part. So difficult not to fall into a trap when you've got somebody like that who is so power hungry and so cynical.
No, I think it's true, and so unscrupulous. I think that's true.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Ambassador Snyder, what do you think then, given the warnings that you had about identity politics, there's a lot of concern, of course, that Putin has been meddling in European elections. He's given money to Le Pen and to Orban in Hungary. And there's a possibility that could be, you know, with things go worse in Syria, which they certainly could get worse, and it's hard to believe it could get any worse than it is. The last big outflow of refugees coincided with Russia's intervention, so there's a possibility there could be even more refugees coming in. So is there, I think, a long-term solution to the integration of refugees from the Middle East in Europe?
I think that Germany has shown the way to a long-term solution to the integration of the refugees. I mean, you have to make it possible for them to become part of society, and I fear that countries may learn this the hard way, but that is certainly the only solution, and I'm embarrassed to say this as an American when our response under President Trump is so massively unhelpful and lacking any kind of compassion or responsibility as a global citizen, much less, well, which I don't think we are anymore, but much less as a global leader. And, you know, it's very challenging. It's challenging for countries like Holland, which even though they have a tradition of diversity and tolerance dating back to the 17th century, in the nearer present, they didn't have a history of a great deal of migration. They're not like the United States, Canada, and Australia. They're not a country of immigrants. So that is something to adjust to. And when I was there, the adjustment was in one direction, and people were trying to be very tolerant and saying, well, we don't want to impose our Dutch identity on people. We have to let people, you know, practice their own traditions in our country. Well, that didn't work very well because, of course, to survive and thrive in a country, you have to learn the language, you have to learn the tradition, you have to learn the history. And so now I hear people saying, well, we want people to become Dutch. We want people to become like us. Well, that's not going to happen either. You know, there is something in between where you make your traditions and history accessible and understandable, which wasn't the case when I was there. Just a small example, the book on citizenship in 2000 had about 5 pages on how to pay your bills at the post office, and about 1 paragraph on the 17th century. So you have, you know, if you want people to be part of your country, you have to make it open and accessible to them. To their credit, the Dutch didn't do that so much because of their characteristic modesty. Now I think they understand that, you know, that modesty in this case isn't particularly helpful, that you have to make your own identity accessible for people to try to enable them to become part of it, but you can't ask them to become it. Sure. And that's, of course, what makes the United States, and I think Canada and Australia too, but it's something the United States is particularly proud of, a great country, because we honor diversity. And that is actually the heart of our country's identity. And it is astonishing to me that we have a president who doesn't seem to have the slightest understanding of that.
Well, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who's a distinguished professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution from 1998 to 2001. She served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.